The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the management and staff of Guardian Radio.
Good evening, Bahamas. This is Urologist Speaks with Bahamian urologist Dr. Gregory Pinto and my two co-hosts this evening. Firstly, it's Dr. Wesley Francis, who is a Bahamian general surgeon and oncologist, which is a surgical cancer expert. And we have, again, thank you very much for coming here, the well-known Dr. Devon Curling, who is a Bahamian hematologist, internist, and medical oncologist. We're here talking about, in the month of October, breast cancer awareness, which is all important in our country, and no one can dispute that. So we're here offering hope. We're trying to dispel myths and inaccurate misconceptions regarding breast cancer. So we're talking every aspect of breast cancer, from risk factors to management to screening. What we want to do is we want to make sure that nobody's dying of breast cancer. No one needs to be dying of breast cancer. If we can pick up prostate cancer early, you can survive. If you can pick up colon cancer early, you can survive. No one needs to be dying of any of the big three, and that's breast cancer, colon cancer, and prostate cancer. Thank you, and welcome again to the Urologist Speaks, Dr. Devon Curley.
Thank you. Glad to be here, Dr. Pinto.
So, Dr. Wesley Francis, I know that you have at your fingertips a lot of the data in terms of breast cancer rates throughout the years. Are we seeing a positive trend? Obviously, the numbers are always going up, but in terms of age and distribution, I know that we are seeing, usually in the past, breast cancer at younger ages than our other nations around the earth. Is that still the case, or is the trend changing in any way?
So, Greg, thank you again for having me here and co-hosting with you. And good evening, Bahamas. It is always a pleasure to be here to have a conversation about your health. And, you know, October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month. And so myself and my good esteemed colleague, Dr. Curling, who treat breast cancer on a daily basis every year, not only in October. And, you know, we're here to sort of bring awareness, of breast cancer. Now, we started to really look at breast cancer incidence in about 2018, when the Bahamas National Cancer Registry was established. And at that time, the decision was made that we will start counting forward. Prior to that, the data on breast cancer was really coming out of Princess Margaret Hospital. But then once the registry was established, and then, you know, this was established by the government, it was legislation that was passed, and it's actually a registry within the region. I think we're the only one that has actually legislation that actually, brought about the cancer registry. And so in 2018 was when we first started to see and compile data, true data, that represented both what was in the public sector and also represented what was in the private sector. And so the first set of data we got was 103.6 per 100,000 of the population. And that's how incidence is reported per 100,000. And so 103.6 was astounding, and that was probably one of the highest recorded that I even know of breast cancer. I think the only other country that was high as that was somewhere in the Baltic states. And so we were all astonished by that, because prior to that, the numbers were somewhere in between 50 per 100,000, and we started to see these double rates. In 2019, it was still as high as 100, 101 actually. And then we saw a drastic drop in 2020, and we thought that this might have been because of the pandemic, because, you know, during that year, a lot of people weren't getting screened. And so, I mean, all of us who were in this space decided, and watching this data, we felt that it's probably going to rise again. But what we've seen really over the last 4 years, and we have 4 years of data, is that it's somewhat stabilized around 70, 77, 76. And the data usually lags behind, and that's usually what cancer registry data do. They do lag behind. So the latest data we have is of 2023.
But that means that we don't capture those who have treatment abroad for the most part.
So not really. I mean, we still, if you've had your diagnosis done here, for example, a lot of people still get the initial biopsy done in the Bahamas, and then they go off for treatment. So we still capture them. The registry is still trying to develop or establish some kind of data sharing agreement with, especially the state of Florida, because most people would, you know, would go to Florida, so that we can capture the treatment data and compare it with what we have here. But I think for the majority of people who do go away, they still would have had their initial diagnosis done here. Most of this data actually comes from pathology data. So if you had had a biopsy, that biopsy would have been read in PMH. It would have been read in Doctor's Hospital. And one of the people who really support the data, I mean, the registry, is Fort Terrace Diagnostics. And we get all of Fort Terrace Diagnostics data. And so, and we're here also to encourage the others to, you know, the other centers, other where biopsies are done, to send their information into the registry. And so I'm pretty confident that we get the majority. We don't get all, but I'm pretty confident that we get the majority of the data.
So we've spoken many times in the past. In fact, the three of us were here a year ago for Breast Cancer October Awareness Month, and we talk about breast cancer. Breast cancer is a very complex and varying disease where there are at least five subtypes, three main ones, but it's a very, what we call, heterogeneous disease. Prostate cancer is basically prostate cancer. Colon cancer, there's some variations, but speak to us a little bit, Dr. Devon Curling, about the different subtypes of breast cancer and the distribution that we usually find here. I know that we talk a little bit about triple negative, which has a worse prognosis, usually hits women of African ancestry and younger women. And there's a higher rate in this country than, let's say, in North America, United States, or Canada.
So I think that's a really important point that we have to realize now. So breast cancer is not all the same disease. And many times we'll have patients come in and they'll say, well, you know what? My disease was stage 2B and my friends was stage 2B, and why is my treatment so different? And we have to realize now that we're in the age of tailor-made medicine, essentially. So when we look at the classical characteristics that we've always checked for, the hormone receptor status and the HER2-new, that generally puts patients into triple positive, hormone receptor positive, HER2-new positive, or triple negative. And those were the four main categories that influence treatment in the adjuvant setting. Other things that also influence that within those are grade. So when we think of a tumor grade, we think of how aggressive it is, how rapidly will a tumor grow. So that also impacts the recommendations that we would make. And depending on what those are, each one is different. Then we add in whether someone is node positive or not. We add in the tumor size, and all of these impact how we would treat. Now, this is, those main markers are purely for what we call the adjuvant setting, which is, would be after my colleague here, Dr. Francis, has operated on someone and sent that patient forward. When we get into more advanced disease or stage four disease, that algorithm expands even more because then we start actually looking at other mutations that we can specifically target. And we're finding newer treatable targets all the time. And so this is why when people come and they're expecting, oh, I'm going to get this, and I say, no, actually what the guidelines say is that we need to treat you with this and you don't need this treatment and so on, there tends to be some confusion. And lots of times people will go for multiple different opinions because they're hearing all of these variables. For instance, one of the things that's come out in the last few years, if you want to talk about tailor-made treatment, is the oncotype. And what the oncotype does is it actually gives you a risk recurrence score. And based on that, for certain categories of patients, if you have a low score, because what this test does is it looks at certain genes in the cancer specimen itself, and based on that score, there are some patients that don't even need any chemotherapy. And so we're getting much better at tailoring who needs what therapy and who doesn't need therapy and so on. So it's really exciting times now in terms of picking and choosing what we're going to do.
I mean, the same is for in urology for prostate cancer. We do, in the last several years, we do genomic testing on every, or we should, or we have availability of, and I do it as often as I can, for prostate cancer biopsies so that we can stratify them into who's higher risk, who's lower risk. It said maybe 20, 25%, maybe 30% of prostate cancers are quite aggressive, and that we need to know these are the aggressive types and that we need to be very diligent and very active in curing someone. But the other ones are usually 70, 75% are quite indolent. The same for recurrence. When we do genomic testing, we can actually use even AI. We can do we can actually stratify and say that someone has a 15% chance of recurrence in the next 20 years. Someone has a 2% chance. So obviously, those that have a higher risk, we're going to monitor them a lot closer. We've spoken about this again many times. Breast cancer is a very common topic. But in the last 25 years, the management has changed drastically, Dr. Francis, in terms of usually everything 25 years ago was surgery first. And then now surgery is usually the last step.
Well. So it goes back to the personalized medicine, as what Dr. Curling had mentioned. And so, yes, before, even with, we used to kind of stratify it in this way. If you had early disease, you would go to surgery. If your disease was what we call locally advanced, you would get chemotherapy up front to kind of shrink it down, and then we do surgery. If you had metastatic disease, meaning stage four disease, we'd not likely do any surgery for you. But now, with the advent of molecular testing, and putting and hormone receptors evaluation, putting breast cancer in these different subtypes, we now treat early breast cancer in a different way. So, for example, early triple negative breast cancer or early HER2 positive breast cancer, which would in time past have had surgery first, they are now actually are candidates for chemotherapy first, or immunotherapy, or targeted therapy. And we put all of those chemo, target, immuno into one basket called systemic therapy, where you're treated with medication first prior to any surgery. So that has been the real game changer. And we've seen the outcomes improve substantially when patients start to, especially the triple negative patients who now get immunotherapy, the patients who are HER2 positive get targeted therapy with Herceptin. All of this is now a part of the whole personalized medicine. And so the initial workup for somebody with a lump, it's actually a lot more detailed. It's a lot more history involved. There's a lot more testing involved. And we have to wait before so that we can gather all of this information and tailor the therapy to the individual and to the tumor that's specific to them. And so things have really changed. And we're seeing a huge better outcomes because of this. And this is where the data is moving. This is where guidelines are moving. And in fact, I think many years ago, we started doing this even before the guidelines changed, because we recognized that even our patients who had advanced tumors were treated, especially the triple negative tumors were treated with chemotherapy, their tumors kind of melt away. So we started doing it with them that early, and we saw that they benefited. And then the guidelines changed afterwards. But so this is how the pendulum has swung in the last maybe 5-10 years.
Yeah. Well, I had to do general surgery before I did urology. So maybe 17 years ago, I had to do my high volume of mastectomies. I was in breast cancer clinics seeing high volume centers, seeing. But a lot has changed since then. So obviously, I want to say that the public are blessed to have not only national experts in the form of Dr. Wesley Francis and Dr. Devon Curling, but regional and internationally recognized experts in breast cancer. So we're very blessed to have the two foremost experts, along with Dr. Theodore Turnquist, who is not here, who are going to give us all the information in the cutting edge. So even for ER positive, I would say, in NCI in 1999, 2000, any breast cancer that was ER positive, 1 centimeter, everyone got chemotherapy. Now with genomic testing, many of these people, these women can avoid chemotherapy, particularly those who are node negative, even though some of those who are node positive, because with genomic testing, we've discovered with more information that we're understanding of breast cancer, that chemotherapy doesn't improve their cure rate. So that's good news for a lot of women who previously would have received chemotherapy with all the numerous, in many cases, horrible side effects, and now it's not necessary. Can you speak a little bit more on that?
I think the message really is to know the subtype.
Yes.
Because chemotherapy, immunotherapy, targeted therapy is essential for these specific top subtypes, and you start up front. What you speak of is really hormone positive. And this is where what Dr. Curling had mentioned, which is the oncotype. The oncotype, so hormone-positive early breast cancer still goes to surgery first.
Yeah.
But then on the back end, and this is the term that we use as adjuvant, is really after surgery. That's when the oncotype comes in to play. Because a lot of those patients, as you would have mentioned, may not have benefited that much from chemotherapy because their disease was perhaps very indolent. And so you want to pick out the best set, and they don't need any aggressive therapy. And the ones that are the bad actors in that group, you need to give more intensive chemotherapy. And so that's what the oncotype, as Dr. Curlin mentioned, even node negative and node positive patients now, they can be stratified. And so they can avoid chemotherapy, you know?
So in any cancer, we want to talk about local control and we want to talk about systemic control. Dr. Curling, can we speak a little bit? What's the importance in cancer about systemic control? Obviously, we want to get the cancer, the mass itself, but we want to make sure that it doesn't recur.
Right. So, I mean, that's where the whole concept of a systemic therapy comes in, right? So we know from years ago back in the 40s, 50s, and so on, that people would present with tumors, we'd cut them out, and invariably, they'd come back. So a lot of the initial studies were done with mustard agents and so on. And then as we got more and more advanced, we noticed that if you gave people chemotherapy or a systemic therapy after their surgery, that the recurrence rates were significantly reduced. So I tell people to kind of break it down. The easy way to think of it is when you have a cancer that's growing in tissue, it has roots, right? So think of it like a weed that's in your yard. If you pull that weed up and you leave one tiny speck of a root behind, 2 weeks later, that same weed is going to grow back. So what we want to do is remove the tumor with surgery locally, and then afterwards you give the chemotherapy or systemic therapy. We call it systemic therapy because it goes to everywhere. Once it enters your bloodstream, wherever blood goes, it goes. So if there's some tiny cancer cell that's sitting somewhere in the lung or liver or elsewhere, then that therapy can kill that cell and therefore stop the recurrence. So that's what we mean when we say systemic control. Local control is done with surgery, and then in some instances, we add radiation to it after.
So when we talk about systemic control and we're talking about chemotherapy, in layman's terms, chemotherapy kills good and bad cells. Let's talk more about the advent and the progress of immunotherapy and what wonderful things it's doing.
So when we look at the PD-L1 drugs and so on, so there are certain markers in your T cells that there are PD-L1 ligands.
I think we have Granny sitting and saying, what are you talking about?
Okay. So we'll change it. Yeah, we'll just say that the way that immunotherapy works is that it actually stimulates your own immune system
T cells
to kill the cancer cells or to help to kill the cancer cells. Every day in our body, we form little cancer cells, and our immune system is able to go ahead and attack it. Certain cancer cells find ways to evade that. So by stimulating your immune response, we're actually enhancing that so that these your own body is actually now attacking the cancer cells.
So we talk about why we have such a high incidence. Obviously, we always hear about BRCA gene, but it's actually not the gene itself. All of us have BRCA gene. We have all have two copies of BRCA gene 1 and BRCA gene 2, and it's actually a good thing. It's a gene suppressor. So when you have abnormal DNA replication and it halts that or repairs DNA abnormalities before it goes on to make cancer cells. So it's actually something that all of us are born with, men and women. And I'll remind me of the point that men can get breast cancer. We'll talk a little bit about that in a second. A lot of men will have lumps and they ignore it until it becomes a fungating mass, and it's not very common. What are the percentages you think? Maybe about 3%, Dr. Francis, of all cancers are in men?
Sure. You mean breast cancer?
Yeah.
We literally, at least in the registry, I speak from the registry, we have at least 3 cancers or 3 patients or breast cancers that occur in men.
Okay.
A year.
Okay.
That's what I've seen almost consistently every year. There's about 3 men that get breast cancer. Now, I don't think we record all of them. Yeah. But they do. But the thing to recognize is that those men who do have breast cancer, at least 50% of them, at least this is what the data says, have BRCA positive. And so this is why men tend to get breast cancer. And so if you're a family and you have a man with breast cancer, then that's a high-risk family because it's likely that there is a mutation in that BRCA gene in that family.
And BRCA gene 1 and 2 can lead to innumerable cancers, not just breast cancer.
Yes.
We're talking pancreatic cancer, endometrial cancer, skin cancers, prostate cancer.
Ovarian
as well, yes. Yeah. So yeah. What percentage of our population would you say, Dr. Devon Curling, would you estimate to have BRCA gene mutations?
So in the first studies that we did, now you have to remember, so we chose high-risk patients. And even taking that into consideration, our number was astronomical kind of in that study because what we found was that fully about 24% of those patients were positive. The interesting thing was that the majority of them were BRCA1. I think we had very few BRCA2 patients. So,
but those were women already known to have breast cancer?
Yes.
So it's not just a general population.
No.
So we can't really extrapolate.
Group.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Selective group.
That's very skewed. So those numbers are...
The majority of them were young and majority of them had bilateral cancers.
But even taking that into consideration, when you looked at other high-risk studies that have been done, that was still the highest that had been recorded. I mean, it was still 24% in a highly selected group is still a very high percentage.
There's no other, in the literature, there's no other reports that is higher than that.
Yep. Wow. And what is unique to the Bahamas? Obviously, we're primarily of African ancestry. Is it because we have a smaller population and a smaller gene pool? What are the reasons that we have this issue?
I'll let Curly.
Well, I mean, it's obviously you're in a small population, bad genes get propagated a lot easier. So if it's kind of like, if you think about it, if you have a founder gene, let's say that I move to Rumkey and I have a gene that causes colon cancer. I have five children. Three out of those five have that gene. They then go on to marry within that population. So the gene gets propagated and doesn't get diluted out. That's an easy and oversimplified way to think of it.
So we can extrapolate that and say that...
I'm not going to go there tonight, Dr. Pinto.
We're not going to go there tonight, Dr. Pinto. We are not going to go there.
So we want to dispel... Positive immigration can be a good thing for our population. We need to expand our gene pool.
I'm not even going there with you, right? But the bottom line is that certainly in a small population... If you have a mutation in any small population, that's just scientific, right? And that population, again, because it's small and it's closed, obviously a mutation can then just spread like wildfire, right? And the genes that we have, and Dr. Kerlin mentioned a founder mutation, and these are the same genes that were found in West Africa. So it speaks to our ancestry that we came from West Africa, we brought those genes over. And think about, you know, there's supposed to be some benefit of a mutation. At least that's in, because if you look in West Africa, there's malaria, right? A founder mutation, there's a mutation in the gene that leads to sickle cell. That's a founder mutation, and that's supposed to be a protective mutation because then in that situation, it protects the population from malaria, right? And it doesn't allow it. So again, this mutation is supposed to have some benefit, but we just don't know what that benefit is.
Well, when we have advanced staged cancers, breast cancers and other cancers, the cancers are very ingenious. They can actually mutate and they can bypass, for example, androgen deprivation blockade or whatever immunotherapy we're throwing at, and then we have to alter the way that we attack the disease. So cancer is just, every cancer is different. The way the cancer responds is different. So we have to tailor, particularly for breast cancer, every treatment modality that we institute for our patients. We have a call coming in. Good evening. This is Urologist Speaks.
How are you doing?
We're very well. Thank you.
All right. How are you doing, Dr. Pinto?
I'm great.
Well, you saved my life one time, no?
Oh, yeah. Thank you for saying that.
But I have my auntie. She married this guy, but on his side of the family, I talk with all the sisters, everyone cancer is like 90-80%.
Probably has some gene mutations in his family.
Yeah. So now her kids now. She already lost her daughter. One already have a breast off, one just get a breast off. So it's talking her kids now too. His side of the family on my auntie's side now. So I look at this now, it's the screening, I mean, it's like the blood. I mean, people don't really test out and see how good the people blood is or what in the system or whatever. Do you think people do that like they really before they get involved with this poison, they test, because a lot of people get involved with woman and man, and then some of the majority, 90% of the kids, every child they have, either be retarded, be this or that or whatever. So I see it happens. You know what I mean? This person have to take a needle, she have to take a shot every time she have a baby, else it wouldn't be normal. So I think we have to start testing out when you get involved with certain people, then you have to test it out because your generation might be at risk.
Yeah, you do make a point. There's a lot in terms of gene testing that's done, particularly within families, and you need to know your family history, and you need to know the family that you're marrying into. Even we're doing that with, we've discussed that before, Dr. Kerling, sickle cell. So if you know that you have the trait or if you actually have the full-blown disease, you have to make that discussion with your spouse if they also have the trait or the disease, because it could be devastating. Sickle cell can be even more devastating than cancer, particularly for a young person. So yes, that discussion has to come about. We also have to talk about the logistics of it and the legal aspect of it. If you're doing gene testing on everyone, that means that when you go for insurance, they're going to maybe deny you based on pre-existing conditions, or they might put a premium on you that you'll never be able to afford because they anticipate that you're going to have a cancer that they're going to have to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars to manage. So as the world gets more complicated, there are a lot of nuances that we have to look at in terms of insurance, in terms of coverage, in terms of who do we test and what information that we provide and who's that information provided to, because you can actually be prejudiced in terms of your future, in terms of are you going to get that promotion. Mike, in 20 years, you might, okay, you have this gene mutation that's likely going to cause you to have a cancer. This may affect every aspect of your life.
So that's important because in the U.S., there's a law called GINA, G-I-N-A, which is Genetic Information Non-Discriminatory Act. And so before we start to have widespread testing and disclosure of people's genetic information, we need to be able to protect people. And so it's something that I think that our legislature need to consider, because it's an important aspect of our population, especially with young women, right, who end up with BRCA positive, and that information, if that gets out there, they can, there's no law to protect them.
Yep. And it's actually one of the things that I spend a lot of time talking to patients about, because they'll come in and they'll be like, "Doc, why don't I get tested?" And if you're 30, 40 years old and you're just getting your career started, you're about to get married, or you're about to do this, buy a house, I have to explain to them, you know, to get any mortgage in this country, you need life insurance. If you have tested positive, the life insurance company is going to require you to disclose that. That may exclude you. And it's really sad, given the amount of genetic disease we have in this country. It's something that really needs to be addressed so that we can protect the population, because lots of people, once that's out there, your medical insurance, you probably won't be able to get it. So it really is a life changer.
Which will discourage a lot of people who know that from even getting tested, which can be disastrous in itself. Knowledge is key. So we're here volunteering our time, trying to, even if we can save one young lady or middle-aged lady or older lady from dying a needless death of advanced breast cancer, or maybe we can encourage one woman to be diagnosed with stage one breast cancer instead of stage four, that's worth our time. But we always talk about a lot of misconceptions. A lot of women think, okay, my cousin has double D breasts and I only have A cup. I don't have any risk because my breasts are so small. But we have to talk about the anatomy of breast cancer and what is made up of the breast tissue. So breast tissue is mainly non-specific fat and stromal tissue and glandular tissue, which are basically the milk-generating part of the breast. So it's really the glandular component of the breast that is pretty much consistent despite the size of the breast. And that is the part of the breast that leads to breast cancer. The rest of it is fat and adipose tissue. And it is, if you look at extremes where someone has triple F breasts, or and that would be usually correlated with obesity. Obesity can give you a greater risk to some degree of increased risk for breast cancer. Not really say obesity per se, but because of the increased inflammation related to obesity, the greater hormonal, the growth hormones associated related to the insulin resist, the greater visceral fat around the organs, all that can increase the risk of cancer. But per se, someone with a type A cup and someone with a type D cup, their breast cancer risk is approximately the same.
Well, as long as a woman has breasts, then they have a risk of breast cancer. And the number that's put out there is 1 in 12. So 1 in 12 women will get breast cancer. All right? And so I always say, we do not prevent breast cancer. We cannot prevent breast cancer. You want to prevent breast cancer, the only thing that could do that is to remove your breast. So
we can lower our risk.
Let me finish. What we do is to do early detection. That is what the whole emphasis of awareness, emphasis of screening, is to early detect. So that 1 in 12, we want to find that 1, because we know that 1 in 12 will get it. We want to find that 1 at an early stage. And as you mentioned before, the anatomy of the breast is the glandular aspect. If you think about grapes and stem, the stem of the grape is like the duct of the breast. And that's where, and the grapes is like what we call the lobule. The lobule is where the milk is produced, and it passes through the ducts, and that's the stem. The ducts is where 80% of breast cancer develops, all right? And women, A cup, B cup, C cup, D cup, have the same really amount of ducts and lobules. You're born with this with a particular amount. So it doesn't matter. But the whole idea of screening is really that, especially with ductal cancers, because 80% of cancers develop in that duct, is that you get some form of calcifications early in that duct before it becomes invasive breast cancer. So our screening effort is to find what we call non-invasive breast cancer because the calcifications within the ducts appear on a mammogram. And so that's the whole thrust of what we try to do. The whole awareness is about finding that one person, but finding that one person when they have calcifications within that duct at a non-invasive stage, and that person with treatment will have 100% survival.
All right, so I wanted to speak about some positivity in terms of reducing your risk, modifiable risk factors. I'll lead this question to give this question to you, Dr. Devon Curling. Always know, and I think even a lot of laypersons will hear about your lifetime exposure to estrogens. And there have been studies going back 50 years, 70 years, looking at nuns, Catholic nuns, who never will have a child, never breastfeed. What is the increase or decrease in risk in having more than one child and in terms of the length in which you breastfeed?
So I guess the easy way to look at breast cancer is length of exposure to estrogen over your lifetime.
So let me just start with that. Does that mean when we're having children 9, 10 who are having their periods earlier, does that mean their lifetime risk is high?
Yeah. Well, that depends, because if I start having my cycles at the age of 9, but my cycles shut down at the age of 30, that's still a short time period. So it's the age of onset of menarche, meaning when you start to have your periods, the age of onset of menopause, so the later that you go into menopause, the longer your exposure, multiple pregnancies tend to be protective because
it interrupts the cycle.
You're shutting down that cycle. Breastfeeding shuts down that cycle. So breastfeeding can decrease, and that's another good health reason that women should be breastfeeding, because it does decrease that risk. There's a lot of talk about one myth that I would like to clarify, okay? Because the amount of women that come in to see me, and I was just discussing this with a patient today, let's say I have a lady who comes in who's 37, she had breast cancer when she was 30. She's now married, and, you know, she's just lamenting about the fact that she wasn't able to have kids. And I ask her, you know, why? And she says, oh, well, all my doctors told me that if I get pregnant, that my breast cancer is going to come back. That is not true. Okay. So a pregnancy does not increase your risk of breast cancer. Now, there are times when during your pregnancy, people develop breast cancer. And you know what? We treat it. So as long as in your second trimester, we can begin to actually treat you with chemotherapy agents to shrink that tumor, okay? So I just want to dispel that myth, because there's a lot of people that have actually not had children because of that. So those are some important key things. The other things in terms of cigarette smoking and alcohol and so on.
So there was a study that came out in January that 1 in 6 breast cancer cases in the United States they thought was directly linked to alcohol. So right. If you want to reduce your risk of breast cancer, and we're not talking about binge drinking in that study, even if it was moderate alcohol intake, even one drink a day or every other day. I would drink sparingly or not at all. Just across the board, women are not going to want to hear that. But if you particularly are worried because of family history or you're concerned about breast cancer, drink sparingly or not at all. Shouldn't smoke at all for many reasons. It may not be directly increase the risk of breast cancer, but other cancers, whether it's from my perspective as a urologist, bladder cancer, kidney cancer, but cardiovascular risk as well. And then we talk about diet is all important.
Right. So, yeah, and getting back to that, I think you mentioned it briefly before, but let's get back to our biggest pandemic in this country, which is obesity. Okay. And that definitely, that is a risk factor. And we really need to get a better handle on obesity and take it as the crisis that it is, because not only does it affect your cancer risk, it affects your cardiovascular health. It permeates into everything.
And even for breast cancer, particularly, can you just speak about this, either Dr. Francis or Dr. Curling, for menopausal women, obesity, and I remember from my years of general surgery,
right.
There was one study that I remember the numbers. It said if you're 11 pounds overweight as a menopausal woman, you have about 11% increased risk of getting breast cancer. What's the reason for that?
So just as Dr. Curling mentioned, it's about the estrogen exposure. And so in a premenopausal woman, estrogen comes from your ovary. So when your ovary shuts down, essentially you cease producing estrogen. And so that's why a person goes into menopause. Now, in a postmenopausal woman, estrogen can be converted from fat, or rather estrogen can be created in fat cells by an enzyme called aromatase. And so in a situation where women are obese, so the risk is actually in postmenopausal women. And that's when we recognize the most risk, because in a postmenopausal woman, because of the enzyme aromatase, this is where you can then increase your estrogen exposure to the breast. And this is the whole mechanism of why breast cancer risk is increased in postmenopausal women who are overweight. And now we use a drug called an aromatase inhibitor in postmenopausal women, same drug as tamoxifen we use in a premenopausal woman. So that's really the mechanism. And so we encourage our postmenopausal women to really be careful about their weight and obesity, because that's the reason why.
Well, and just to further that, we reviewed like about 10 years worth of patients, and we found that 70% of our breast cancer patients fell into overweight, obese, or morbidly obese, 70%. So it's definitely, and by the way, that was in both premenopausal and postmenopausal. So once again, just getting back to the fact that obesity really is a pandemic in the country.
Let's all talk a little bit more about positivity and in terms of advancements and where cancer screening and treatment is headed. We've also spoken about this in the past, gentlemen, liquid biopsies. So liquid biopsies, we're trying to determine before someone has actual morphology of cancer, before they have the millions of cancer cells clumping together so that you can pick up a breast mass or a nodule. Liquid biopsy, we're looking at strands of DNA in the blood. You only need like 10 mils of blood. We're looking at cell-free DNA. We're looking at the length of the DNA fragments. We're looking at known DNA mutations that are linked to cancers. We're also looking at the methylation patterns that are indicative of cancer. Not only the cancer, if it's present, what is the origin of the cancer? Can either of you or both of you discuss where is our liquid biopsies in terms of use in our country and throughout the world? What is its role in terms of the future of cancer treatment and screening?
So I guess for liquid biopsies, we're actually doing quite a bit of it now. It started really, I'd say a lot of the initial research looking at circulating tumor cell DNA was done in colon cancer and using it to monitor your disease, a response, and so on. But now, when we have, for instance, a young patient or just about all patients now, if we can get what's called next generation sequencing done, which is where we look at thousands of different mutations and we analyze those to give us specific targets. And what we look for is clusters of genes that may have a bad prognosis or that may tell us more details. So we're actually using it quite often now. And what's happening with liquid biopsies is we're advancing to the point where we've identified thousands of different mutations, but we don't know what most of them mean. So we're now clustering those data points from all around the world, and we're using them to say, oh, look, Dr. Pinto has these five mutations, and we found these five mutations in 10 other patients from around the world, and all of these patients got this. So that's one way. In lung cancers, we're using it to find specific targets that we can use to treat these cancers. So there's ROS mutations, ALK mutations, PD-L1 mutations, EGFR mutations, and each one of those, the treatment algorithm is different. So, for instance, 15 years ago in lung cancer, it was chemotherapy and that's it. Now we've got about 20 different classes of drugs that we can use. So it's really changing everything that we do. And as we learn more and more, we haven't gotten to the point where we're using it for screening yet, but probably in time, that's going to be the next step.
So it's more for stratifying.
Right. So, yeah. I mean, at least locally we don't, but there's actually a product out there by this company called Grail that looks at the same circulating tumor DNA. And the whole idea is that if you have a tumor and you're asymptomatic, that's really when you screen, because you want to identify it before you become symptomatic. So tumors that are present, they share their DNA within the blood. And hence, this is where the whole term liquid biopsy comes from. It's just basically a blood test rather than a tissue biopsy, or it's termed liquid biopsy. Now, there is a test that is out there. It's in the U.S., and this company basically runs millions of DNA testing, and they're able to then pick up before it actually happens. It's not available worldwide yet, but we're almost there. It's actually there, and it's available, and it's been advertised at this point. But I think in country, what we usually use, is like you had mentioned with colon cancer, we do use it for monitoring because it's what the term we use is molecular residual disease. And if you, for example, you have a tumor and it's removed, then you should not have any further DNA spilling in your blood. And so if we check the blood for that tumor, circulating tumor DNA, and it's no longer there, then we know that you have a higher chance of being cured. So that is being currently used in country now.
And we're not going to mince words. Breast cancer is devastating our country. It's devastating women on an individual level, devastating families and the society as a whole. You can imagine a 36-year-old getting a diagnosis of breast cancer, losing one breast or both, having to go through chemotherapy. So now they have self-esteem issues. They're worried about their relationships, getting married, having children, losing their hair. They feel disfigured. Let's give them some reassurance as a surgical oncologist, as a surgeon. Who are candidates for lumpectomy? Not everybody needs to have their breasts off. And then we also need to temper that by, if you do need a mastectomy, we can do immediate reconstruction.
Right. So most people are candidates for a lumpectomy. So when we look at
which is what?
Surgical
treatment. Let's not assume people know what that is.
Yeah. So surgical treatment, it's either we can remove the breasts, and that's the term called mastectomy, or we can preserve the breasts, and it's called breast preservation.
And mastectomy involves lymph node dissection?
Yes, it involves removal either of a single lymph node, or in some cases we may have to remove more than one lymph node.
And
right?
A lot of people will hear the word sentinel node biopsy. What is that?
Sentinel lymph node biopsy is basically where you try to identify that single node or that first node which cancer would spread to. And if you identify that node, it gives you an indication of what the rest of the nodes are saying. And so we do that, especially in patients who, when they present to us, you cannot feel any lymph nodes. So they have to initially be node negative for us to do that.
Yeah.
All right. But so mastectomy is removal of the breast. And then we do breast preservation. Breast preservation can be anywhere from removing the tumor with negative margin, meaning with normal breast tissue. And we have various ways in which we do that. And one of the terms we use is lumpectomy. We call it sometimes even partial mastectomy. We sometimes even call it quadrantectomy. But the idea is that the tumor itself is removed with a rim of normal tissue around it. But the remaining breast has to be treated with radiation. So lumpectomy doesn't go by itself. So breast preservation involves some form of tumor removal, but with the addition of radiation. And when you couple the radiation with the lump or whatever tumor removal, that is just as equal to a mastectomy. And so that's why we say to patients that you don't have to lose your breasts, okay? Because the survival is essentially the same if you add the radiation component to the lumpectomy.
And then when we talk about immediate reconstruction, does that mean sparing the nipple and the areola complex?
Some patients are candidates. So remember we spoke about the ducts. And so those ducts drain right directly into that nipple areola complex. If that is not involved, then there's an opportunity to spare the nipple. But it also depends on the size of the breasts, because the blood supply, meaning the nutrition from the nipple, comes from the side. If you have a very, very large breast, the blood supply getting to that nipple will be compromised if you try to save it. And so that's why people with smaller cup sizes, and if a tumor is not central or not involving the nipple areola complex, they are candidates for nipple sparing mastectomy, and that's what we call it.
But plastic surgeons are magicians. They can reconstruct. They can make a nipple. They can tattoo and make an areola. That's the least of the worry.
But I really want to emphasize, right? Because I hear this all the time. People say that they didn't know that we do this. We don't have plastic. We have excellent plastic surgeons in the country, and you know, myself as a surgical oncologist removing the breast. At the same sitting, the plastic surgeon comes in and reconstructs the breast. So the woman can come in with breasts and then leave with breasts.
And is that always involve a saline implant? Can you use flaps to create?
There are options. There are options to use some sort of implant-based or what we call tissue-based. And that's a discussion that the patient would have with the plastic surgeon. And they give them the option that's best suited for them. So even in the reconstruction phase, there's a personalized medicine or personalized surgery. And all of this is available locally.
So we haven't talked enough about screening. That's all important because we want to pick up prostate cancer when it's stage one. And the survival is 95-97% for 10 years for almost all of the subtypes of breast cancer, even triple negative. There are great advances in terms of treatment, and they usually used to have a very poor, or relatively poor prognosis. But when should someone, a typical Bahamian woman, at what age should they go for their first mammogram? How often should they have mammograms? We have a lot of women who have denser breasts, who have the option of not only doing mammogram but ultrasound, and who makes that decision?
So that's a very loaded question. Okay. And it's based, there's some nuance associated with it. So let's say someone doesn't have risk factors. Okay, so you got to talk average risk woman. So an average risk woman who has the 1 in 12 chance of having breast cancer, we say that you should start getting screened at age 40 with a mammogram, right? Now, with the it's required as part of your report to report density and as part of the mammogram. And if you have increased density, you should also get an ultrasound. So it's not automatic that you get an ultrasound. But certainly if you have more dense breasts, then you should get a mammogram. But what I want to say first is to understand what are we doing? You are trying to use a test to find stage zero breast cancer. Because that's what I was saying, non-invasive. Because within the ducts, you have calcifications, and the mammogram is simply an X-ray. And that X-ray can pick up those calcifications. So when you talk about screening, you talk about screening, so it's trying to identify an abnormality in a patient who has no symptoms. So if someone presents with a lump in the breast, that's no longer screening, all right? And so we need to talk about population medicine versus individual medicine. And when we look at our population, we start screening the average risk woman at age 40. But, and that's with the tool, which is the mammogram. And that's because mammogram is most effective at that age.
Even for women with dense breasts? Even for women,
if they have dense breasts, you just add on the ultrasound. Now, if you are not an average risk woman and you are a higher risk, this is where the individualized screening plan has to come about.
And I also want to mention, we do have 3D mammography, which is even greater resolution available.
Everybody has 3D mammography. Yes. There's no place within the Bahamas. That's the standard right now.
Yes.
Right?
So you don't have to go.
There's no one over the other.
You don't have to go abroad.
Cleveland Clinic don't have anything more than what we
exactly.
have here.
Exactly. That's the point.
Just
that's
so that people would know that, yes. Right? And it probably costs five times the cost over there than it is here. But nonetheless, back to the screening, okay? So the whole idea, when you get down to an individual now, and this is where I always recommend that women have a family physician, because that family physician can then discuss with that patient or that individual what their individual risk is. And now if you tend to be in a high-risk individual, then screening should start earlier, okay? And so at that point in time, if you find yourself in a high-risk family, your screening should probably start at age 25.
And that's okay? Every year after
that's
that?
25.
And that means 26, 27,
yes.
28? Okay.
It started at 25. Now, we used to say you could end at about 75, but now there's certain guidelines that say you end when you don't have life. Okay?
So if you're
a high-risk person.
Is there anyone that needs a mammogram every 6 months?
There's no guidelines currently that mention mammograms every 6 months, okay? Now, if you're a high risk person and we start screening at 25, mammogram is not the best tool in a 25-year-old, okay? So at that point, breast self exam and exam by a professional and even ultrasound may be better at that person there. If you're someone who is also a part of a BRCA family, this is where MRI comes in. And an MRI is better suited to screen that person and not necessarily a mammogram. So
let me just ask.
The take home here, right, is when we're looking at population screening and the average risk, yeah, we start at 45. But I'm encouraging 40. Women, 40, sorry. Yeah. But I'm encouraging women to have an individual discussion with their family physician, and if they're a higher risk and based on their family tree and their family risk factors, then they should be screened earlier.
So again, I'll use this opportunity to advocate to those in charge that the public system needs an MRI. Again,
absolutely.
We need it for screening for breast cancer, number one cancer for women in this country. We need it for prostate cancer in terms of screening, in terms of staging, in terms of even surveillance. We need it. The two number one killers in our country are cardiovascular disease. So even if you come in with a stroke, you need an MRI. So the argument is a moot point. We desperately need not just one MRI, we need two MRIs in the public system, and enough said. And you can further that. There's so many innumerable ways you as an oncologist fundamentally need an MRI, and it'll save lives. We're trying to pick up cancers when they're early. And you would know more than any of us the cost. We're not even get away from the emotional costs and everything else. The financial cost to the institution, to the government, to the public purse for some of these drugs, it might cost $8,000-$10,000 just to keep someone alive a few months, not even with the best quality of life, versus if we had put it at the front end and picked up these cancers early, we wouldn't have gone down that road.
But I think we need to get the population involved in screening. Right, and I think this is where policy. We need some policy in place to talk about population screening. Yes, individuals have their own responsibility, and I will encourage every woman to have a family physician, and who will establish what their risk, whether they're an average risk woman or a high risk woman, and then that'll determine when they get screened and what tool that they use to be screened. But we have to have some kind of policy regarding a population screening.
So let's talk about a 45-year-old female who, for the last 5 years, has had four mammograms, and each one of them she dreads because it's so uncomfortable. It's painful to her. Literally, your breast is being pressed on like a pancake. And she has the means. And can she come to you as her physician and say, I don't want mammogram, I'll pay out of pocket, or even my insurance will pay for it, I want an MRI?
I would tell her no.
Okay.
Okay? If she's an average risk woman, she doesn't need an MRI. And then here's the issue with the MRI in an average risk woman. An MRI will pick up everything. So that means it will pick up something benign, and so what happens is it's too sensitive in that situation. And what will happen is that it would increase the amount of biopsies. And then we have a lot of false negatives.
And then we have to talk about the emotional cost of false negatives.
Of false negatives, yeah. Okay? So that's why...
False positives,
right. Yeah. So this is why there's some nuance associated with it. You just can't MRI everybody. We MRI everybody. Almost everyone who gets an MRI will have some kind of abnormality. All right? And that's the problem.
Yes.
And that's why you can't use it at a population level for average risk women.
Yes. So as an oncologist, Dr. Curling, I've seen it from men, from women of all ages, in terms of cancer treatment, even in terms of just systemic treatment for curable disease, much less advanced disease or metastatic disease. A lot of persons will see their family members go through chemotherapy and they'll say, you know what, I'd rather die than chemotherapy. Talk about chemotherapy and their quote-unquote milder forms of chemotherapy for certain cancers as well that are a lot better tolerated than those of old that we just used to throw the kitchen sink at you and hope that it killed the cancer and obviously caused a lot of good cells to be killed as well.
Yeah, I think when we look at the chemotherapy aspect of things, people that witness family members that go through real trauma and severe toxicities and side effects, these tend to be family members who are on prolonged chemotherapy courses because they have advanced disease. We're not treating them for a cure. We're treating them, as you say, to try and keep them alive for an extra year or 2 years or 3 years. When it comes to screening appropriately and we're catching disease early, then we're dealing with a situation where we're giving these chemotherapy agents for a limited portion of time. So maybe once a month for four cycles. When you explain that to someone, most people will say, okay, you tell me that this will be over in 4 months? Great. The other thing is that in
and
this...
Does everybody lose their hair?
It depends on the therapy that's recommended. So not all chemotherapy will cause you to lose your hair. But I think people...
And your hair will grow back if
it's going to grow back. And some people say it grew back straighter and nicer and all this other stuff. So who knows? Yeah. But I think people have to realize also that it's not that the drugs have changed. We have made multiple advances in the actual therapies. But our ability to control the side effects has astronomically improved, right? So the days of people grabbing buckets in the movies and you see them bent over, throwing up and things like that, that doesn't happen anymore. We have fantastic drugs that control nausea, that control vomiting. So people are just, they feel kind of queasy. Fatigue is another one, but the majority of patients that we're treating in the early stage setting, in the adjuvant setting, they continue to go to work every day while they're getting their treatment.
And then there's a lot of concern with women, particularly in who want to have children. Does chemotherapy affect your fertility? Do you need to freeze your eggs before you start chemotherapy?
It can, and there are specific situations where we advise patients that they should consider harvesting eggs. So chemotherapy can definitely do that. It's age-dependent. It's agent-dependent also. So those are conversations that we would usually have.
It was been a very knowledgeable show. Any closing statements, Dr. Francis?
We just need to continue to promote screening and bring breast awareness.
And Dr. Curley?
Once again, screening is key, but I think people have to realize that we're in a new age now where we're able to treat people and cure a lot of disease that we could not do so in the past. Do not let fear stop you from getting your screening test done.
Well, thank you for joining The Urologist Speaks. This is Dr. Gregory Pinto, along with Dr. Wesley Francis and Dr. Devon Curling. Have a very safe week, and let's live longer and live better, Bahamas. Good night.